Welcome to the Domestic Abuse Breakthrough Show, where we tackle violence against women and girls through education, empowerment, and hope. Join Kate, a survivor and advocate, as she shares insights, strategies, and stories that inspire healing and action. Together, we'll break the cycle and pave the way for a future of safety and strength. This show contains a trigger warning. And now, here's your host, Kate Beasley.
So welcome back to another episode. And this week we're rejoined by Curtis. Last week we closed off on that episode by talking about discussing the impact domestic abuse and abusive household can have on children and their development. And that childhood trauma doesn't necessarily mean that somebody has grown up in a war zone.
And this is the problem, Curtis, because so many parents will, and this is why I put so much emphasis on not you, people depend on labels too much. Parents actively seek a diagnosis to explain and justify behaviours that are showing up. And unfortunately, it doesn't matter what label you get assigned, the problem's still there. You still have to address it. The label is not an excuse. The label's not a get out of jail card. The label is nothing more than an explanation.
Can I share this with you? This is a very contentious topic we're talking about, right?
It's one that gets me into trouble all the time.
I'm going to do this, and I'll tell you what. Let's do it. Okay, so there's two things here. One is, I'll give you an example of a case and also one of an interview. I had a case which echoes the sentiments of many cases I've had. I worked in an adolescent team, which is, for me, the most challenging team to work in social work, full stop, yeah? Which is why social workers end up leaving those teams so often. Now, you're dealing with a young man, he's about 11, 12 years old, and he has very abusive behaviours towards his younger sister, his mother, physically abusive, and to staff at school. Mm-hmm. And the mother wants him to get made a referral to CAM. So when I picked up the case, his referral had been rejected. They said, we've done a pre-assessment. This is not mental health. People think that CAMs will give their children a mental health diagnosis to explain a problem. And CAMs, on the second referral, said it's behavioral. So when it's behavioral, we point at the parent more so. So what happened was, the mum says, I'm upset with CAMS. She's crying her eyes out because CAMS have let her down. And CAMS has said, there are no mental health issues for this man, young man. Now, he was reasonable with me. He was well behaved with me, as with many of the boys. But when they're with their school and at home, it's really dangerous. So I had an interview.
It's controlled, Curtis. It's controlled. They can control it under certain conditions.
This is why it's not mental health, right?
Exactly.
So I said to, I had an interview with a safeguarding lead, head teacher, and we had to edit out a part of the video. And she said, one of the top issues that we have is when parents are seeking a diagnosis when it's behavioral.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that we are, it's worrying. I think we have a culture.
Okay.
And we have to understand, and I've had so many challenging referrals with parents that are arguing with me when really it's their parenting style. And the issues are is that just like adolescents, I'm glad we're talking about this, these children will be perpetrators of abuse.
100%.
And no one is saying anything. They're trying to get labels. And that's how you end up with Jamies.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, the amount of times that, it's like some people, I'll get into a conversation with people. It's happened to me a couple of times. And in fact, I got so frustrated with it. I actually booked in to speak to, because I've trained with Dr. Jessica Taylor. I booked in with Jess, and I said, right, Jess.
Sorry, is she the blonde therapist I see online?
Dr. Jessica Taylor, yeah, she's a forensic psychologist,
She's
anthropology, anthropology.
from up north as well, isn't she?
She is Staffordshire. Yes, not far from.
Oh, I was supposed to do an interview with her. Yes. Okay.
Oh,
Yeah.
Jess.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's great, Jess. She's
Quite down to earth, isn't she?
oh
She.
yeah, she's lovely. Yeah.
Great. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, I rung Jess. I got on the phone to Jess. I'm like, Jess, right, how do we deal with this? I said, because I'm getting very frustrated here. I said, I feel like I'm being you. She was like, so I said, so basically, it's a case of I'll get into a conversation. So I'll get into a conversation and somebody will agree. So this particular example, she agreed, no, mental health cannot be used as a men shouldn't be used as an excuse for, violent and aggressive behavior. Now, the minute I said, and this is true, unfortunately, and there's lots of examples of this, I've done a couple of professional analysis on a couple of youth cases to show the pattern. I mean, Axel Rudbeckani, prime example, autism, Holly Newton's killer, autistic. And they tried to use autism as, oh, they had an autistic meltdown and they didn't realize what they were doing. And I mean, it's just like, what? So
Yeah.
anyway, I'm like, this, we mental, unfortunately, I said the problem is we have a culture where labels are being used to excuse and brush a problem under the carpet. And that's happening with parents and it's happening within schools. And I said, until this stops, we are always going to have this problem. That's the reality.
It's going to get worse, actually.
The minute I said that, Curtis, she said, oh, no, no, well, my son's autistic and he doesn't understand what he's doing. He doesn't realize. I'm like, oh. And there you go. That's exactly my point. This is exactly my point. Now, she was clearly getting very upset about it, which they do. He hits a nerve. It's a raw nerve because it's a direct, it's they see it as a criticism
Attack
towards
on
them
them.
and their parenting, you see. Well,
Yeah.
it's sometimes, somehow it's my fault.
Yeah.
Well, if I'm to blame, that doesn't sit well with me. So I find it easier saying, well, actually, it's not their fault. It's not my fault. They've got a disorder. That's easier for them easier for them to come to terms with. But, I said to Jess, and how do you deal with this, Jess? And she said, look, at the end of the day, she says, I've got to the point where if it's a professional setting and, I am training them, well, they're there to learn. Well, I will challenge them. She says, if it's an individual, like in this situation, she said, I just say, okay, all right. She says, I won't challenge it because she says, there's no point. She says, unfortunately, it is a case of the culture in society is, and the pharmaceutical. The pharmaceutical has a lot to play in this. The medical world has a lot to play in
Right.
this.
Ah, you're going down.
Where, it's they've been, it's so bad now that people are able, they people think they can self-diagnose. So
I have plenty of parents who do that all the time.
it's just, oh my God. I mean, it's just at the end of the day, the DSM's not worth the paper it's written on. It is the biggest load of the whole world of psychology is the biggest load of garbage going. I mean, in what world, Curtis, would you go to the doctors with some symptoms and they would say, no, you definitely have cancer? It would never happen. Never in a million years would it happen. They would send you for tests before they would do a detailed exploration before they would tell you for certain whether you had cancer or any other illness. Mental health is the only area where you can sit down in front of a psychologist and say, I've got this symptom, that symptom, that symptom. I behave like this, that, and the other. And they would say, no, you're ADHD. No, you're autistic. They're taking an opinion off the individual or a third party. A lot of the time, they don't evaluate, they don't spend enough time with a patient to basically make those observations for themselves and come to that conclusion. That it's based off third party information. So they're not even forming an accurate professional opinion a lot of the time.
you can only conclude,
It's madness.
you can only conclude that there is a little bit of a, there may be a large scale conspiracy to just medicate,
It is.
which is a money, it's about money.
It's worth billions. It's billions, yeah.
There's only that. It's too easy, too much. I remember I worked with this child who was definitely traumatized from their past. There was definite mental health issues, but she went on the internet for her extremely abusive behavior. She was about 14, 15, and read something. And because of the way she read it, she was diagnosed with dyslexia. I was like, well, what about the children who just don't read much at all? Is it a brain, is it a developmental disorder, or is it if you don't read much, you're dyslexic?
I mean, it's a trauma that this can be a so when you've got trauma from the womb, you are born with the same adjust. So when we experience any trauma, we have adjustments that take part in our brain. So the amygdala will physically swell to accommodate the emotional AMPA receptors, which is the internal alarm systems. And the hippocampus, which is our filing cabinet for all our long-term data, physically shrinks, that capacity shrinks. Now, the brain's pliable. When we heal those wounds with the right modalities, that can and our landscape is controlled and not representing danger, that will go back to normal. The brain is pliable. It will go back to how it's supposed to, how it was when we were born. Now, if we experience trauma from the womb, we are born with those adjustments. So we can't go back to something it never was. And this is what people don't get understand.
Don't want to.
A lot of people who are born with ADHD, and in fact, I said this long before I trained with Jess, and long before I even heard Dr. Gabor Mate say it, that it's trauma from the womb. And Gabor Mate says the same thing. Anybody who gets certainly is on the neurodiverse spectrum, it is trauma from the womb. You're born with those adjustments. So because they have an inability to self-regulate when they're born because of their experiences in the womb. So if mum's distressed, and this goes back to the same thing of if you know a pregnant mum is experiencing abuse, you don't just have a duty to safeguard the mum, the adult victim. You have a duty to improve the conditions that that unborn baby is growing up in,
Is this
is
what we're talking about?
developing in.
Are we talking about this in the next section?
We can do it's and this is because people don't understand trauma,
Well,
don't understand childhood
the
trauma.
problem that we have is that I've been to court a number of times, and it just will not go down, not even in court. So, if you address, like you said, if you address someone, it points at them. It's going to cause them a lot of offense, and it will be, it, and this is it. It's like legally, where do we stand on the matter? So, social workers are just another social legal arm of government. We are so limited in what we can say. You can always get, I mean, it's for the courts now to say they will get specifically a psychologist. Or any other therapist to do any kind of assessment, but that's it. That work is not in the system, and if you cause offence, it is a real tear down in court.
I seen a, in fact, I've got it as part in my training material. As a visual, because I thought it's a really important, crucial thing for people, for professionals who don't have a trauma background to see this. And it was part of a lecture that I watched of Dr. Bruce Lipton's, and he, I don't know how it was something was done in Italy. I don't know how they did it, but it was showing the baby in the womb. Mum and dad were having an argument. Dad raised his voice, mum's very upset. As dad raised his voice, the baby physically jumps inside the womb. And that visual is so powerful because people don't realize the how much unborn babies are impacted. And if that's happening from 15 weeks as the brain's starting to develop, we've got a huge problem on our hands. So this is why you're having children that are born with a serious sensitivity to sound, because if they are in the womb, because that's the only trauma is encoded through the senses, sight, sound, smell, taste. So the main prominent, well, the only prominent in the womb sensory stimulus is sound. So if they are hearing loud shouting, crying, screaming, banging at doors, all of these things in the what you know for outside of the womb, and it's scaring the baby, that will be stored as snapshots in the long-term memory. So when that explains why the baby comes into the world and they have an inability to self-regulate, not only has their nervous system been primed for danger from the cortisol being passed from mother to baby via the umbilical cord, because mum's in distress, but the baby's also accumulated sound snapshots, which is what the brain stores away to remember an emotional, inescapable feeling that represents danger. So when that feeling, not the event, the feeling is triggered again, the brain will scan this filing cabinet of snapshots and they'll say, yeah, you bang on, this represents danger. You do not. So that's where when we feel a sudden pang of anxiety, the nervous system won't back down. They will not step down if the critical thinking brain checks that filing cabinet and says, no, actually, no, there is a sound snapshot that is absolutely right from what we've picked up in our landscape at the moment. No, the immediate landscape represents danger. You need to stay in fight flight and we don't step down.
So we're just going to break for a short interval and we shall see you after the break.
Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
So welcome back. So yes, before we broke for the break, we got into the delicate topic of labels. Which is, yeah, it is a very sore subject for many parents, but equally, I certainly keep pressing this point with schools. They need to stop excusing bad behavior or with these labels, because this is why they are dealing with the problems that they're dealing with today in the schools of violence and kids losing their lives. And it's a slippery slope unless we these behaviors. If we teach these children that those behaviors serve a purpose, they get a need met. Well, you're only reinforcing that behavior and it's only going to strengthen that entitlement and it's only going to get worse. So, unless we enforce boundaries very early on and age-appropriate consequences for those behaviors and teach them that's not acceptable, you don't behave like that. We don't roll like that. It's only going to continue, it's excusing it as, oh, it's not their fault, they don't understand, and no, they didn't mean it, and that's not helping them, and it's certainly not helping their victims.
It's always good to understand underlying causes. It's always good to capture the voice of the children and the family. I think what we have to do as well is we have to do we you know in the spirit of journalism, say, we have to apply to some level of data. What does the data tell us about what we are doing? And the data tells us that just one element, permissive parenting and authoritarian parenting, have the worst outcomes for children's well-being, for how they make decisions and how they do relationships and their mental health. It's really negative. Now, focusing on what you were talking about, more the more permissive element where we're making a lot of excuses for, the data shows us that that is not helpful. It doesn't matter how much we want to, because I think what we're doing is we're existing in a part of the solution, but not the wider solution. And in England, in urban areas, or just socially, we have a narrative that is dominant to just looking for possibilities and mitigations. In the real world, I mean, I remember I had a case where a mother was arguing with me throughout the assessment for the longest time about her child who was nearly 16. He was 16, wouldn't go to school, and was sexually inappropriate with a 12-year-old. And two people were witness to it. And she was adamant that they were lying and put it on them in front of the young man. And I'm like, look, these accounts are serious. These disclosures are very serious and are accurate. And she spent the whole time, the whole month, arguing with me that it was his ADHD. Right? So I said, and she said, oh, because he's not been in school for 3 years, he's not socialized very well. But he's out every single day, comes and goes as he pleases for the last 3 years. So I'm saying to mom, look, you have to understand, he's on a trajectory. If no one is showing him any accountability for his behavior, no matter what, he's going to be a perpetrator of serious things because he doesn't know how to respond to no. He doesn't know how to respond to what are you doing. So, the argument was really, when he's 18, nobody will care that he has ADHD. If he keeps doing this to young girls, he's going to be a criminal.
This is a thing. Well, society as a whole is sending a mixed messages to these young people. You can't say, I'm a real stickler for language. I pull people up on it all the time. But it's important. It's like in school, that behavior will be labeled as bullying or being unkind or being mean.
It
And
was. It was on
you,
my part. It was.
yeah, and it was, it's, but it's abuse at the end of the day. It's abuse, it's coercive control or other abuse related crimes. We can't 1 minute say that, oh, it's not criminal behavior. And then the day that they wake up on their 16th birthday, no, now that behavior is a criminal offense. We can't do that. That's you sending these children mixed
Well,
messages.
that's how we can show that we are failing children. I used to work in youth justice, and there were staff that were very afraid to address directly concerning behavior. I remember one member of staff said to me, I know I'm a bit soft, but I don't want to upset him. And I'm like, he's going to be a rapist because he's sexually assaulting other young ladies. What are you doing? Got to tell him, yeah, but, and I'm like, maybe I should get you to tell him. I'm like, you can't. He's already committed an offense. We're working with him. He's gone to court. He's guilty. We have to work with him. You can't pussyfoot around the issue. He has to come to terms with what he's doing. And without that element of account, and this is something I remember I did a video years ago. If you don't, I'm telling social workers, has the parent and or the child, depending on what age, have they demonstrated any insight or accountability? If not, I'm worried. Do we continue the work, yes or no?
It's so important.
If
You have
the
to.
parent says, yeah, it was my mistake, I did it, I shouldn't have done it, I was angry. You could that's a that that case has gone on a different path, but when a parent is making excuses or refusing to talk about it, I worry about tomorrow. And they have children. They're teaching their children that story or rectifying their mistakes. Not a thing. What does that look like in reality?
I mean, I've come across a couple of instances where young children, I'm talking like 5, 6, and 7, have threatened to stab people with knives. Now, that's an indirect threat to kill. Now, people's responses to that is, oh, but they're only little, they don't really understand. We can't take that approach. We cannot take that approach because what if they get curious and think, well, I'm just going to do it just to see what happens? We can't take that approach. And we've got to ask that question, where are they getting that from? They're getting it from somewhere. At that age, that's something that they've heard or observed. And that's worrying.
Absolutely.
Worrying behavior. We cannot afford, we're not, in fact, we are not doing, we're failing. We're not just failing the victims, we are failing them as perpetrating children as well by not holding them accountable. Because if we leave it to slide, it may not, I mean, look at all these cases of late that have, where it's landed them in prison for killing, kids or other peers in schools, in the school environment.
Happens.
Did it need to get to that point? If
No.
somebody had intervened and stepped in and given that child the help and support it they needed early enough in that within their life, would it have, would did it need to escalate to that? Maybe not. Maybe not.
I'll give you an example. I worked with this family. I really liked working with them. They were desperate for help. Mum and dad are not together, but the relationship is complicated because they are and they're not together at the same time. There's one child, just about 11, 12, suicidal attempt, suicidal ideation. Couldn't believe it. When you look at the child, you would never guess. Where are you learning? So it was a real deep conversation with this child. Where are you learning this from? Where did you get the idea to hurt yourself in that particular way? Guess what? YouTube. So there was a YouTube channel and it was an anime channel, sort of an anime channel. Can't remember the name of it now. That the child was watching regularly. And the channel, it was a very expressive, elaborate cartoon, but it promoted suicidal ideation. I did a podcast on this at the time. And the parents had just discovered this. And the reason why she was doing that is because the parents were awful with their not physical, but verbal altercations. It was awful. And I said, you're doing this.
The emotional, the emotional distress, like I said, it can it they create those stories in their head of they will the ch children can blame themselves for it. So we're just going to break for a short interval, and we shall see you after the break.
The station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
So, welcome back. So, before the break, we were talking about childhood trauma and how it's not always obvious. Similarly to domestic abuse, it's just not black and white.
And it's so it's never it's not always obvious childhood trauma, and this is what people really need to start to understand what childhood trauma actually is and how it's formed, because it's not black and white, unfortunately.
If parents step outside of he said, she said, and then really have more conversations around how is this informing my child? And I don't think for 1 minute that children shouldn't hear arguments or see some sad things. It's a part of their development that they see real life, but they have to be exposed with limitations. Every parent should be saying, how will this show my son how to treat women? Show my daughter how to have a partner? How will they do that? What have they learned from me? Et cetera, et cetera.
It becomes your. It's. I refer to it now. It's something I've come up with. I've referred to it as since I did my trauma training. it refer to it as your love story, and it's your association to love, what you observe in your home, in the home environment, how you see your own parents interacting within relationships. That becomes your association to love on a nervous system level. Forget about intelligently as an adult. Intelligently as an adult, you most likely know that's not a healthy way for a relationship to be. You know it doesn't feel good. But on a nervous system level, that is what's familiar, and that's what the nervous system finds safety in and comfort in and reassurance in, is what's familiar. Well, that my parents, that's what love represents. Well, if that's what love represents, you get into a relationship, your partner starts abusing you or being verbally abusive, gaslighting you, name calling you, and you've observed that with your own parents. Well, a lot of the time, people won't associate that with abuse because it's like, well, that's familiar. That's what relationships look like, right? So it's only when things escalate to the point where it's like, well, now I need to get out, but I don't know how, that people.
Can I share this story with you? It'll be my last story, I promise. I love sharing stories. I had this parent, she had two children. Interestingly, this mother, two young children, I think 11 and probably 8 or something like that, and she had been from all of her relationships in her whole life were involving domestic abuse. About 5, 6 relationships she's had. Originally, it was a real struggle to get her to work with us. But we managed to convince her, don't let this escalate. Meet us, let's ha at least have a conversation. So we went to a child in need status, which is voluntary. And I decided to talk to this mum and I said, Mum, I'm going to ask you some tough questions. Do you notice any patterns here? She paused. She gave a bit of a cry, and then she said, "Yeah." So tell me. She goes, "They've all been abusive. All of my relationships." She said, "I don't." She said, "I don't know how to choose." And I said, "I don't want you to lose your kids." And I said, "What do you think they're learning from your choices?" She said, "I know." She says, "I need to not be in any relationships now." I said, "Well done." Now the problem is, well, the interesting side of it is that the children had no signs of trauma, which is another discussion to be had, right? No signs, perfectly compliant, both at home and in school. But they've seen boyfriend after boyfriend beat mum up. And then the other side of it is she's now in a refuge 10 miles from school. So it's massively complicated for the children. I'm encouraging if there's any parents here who are going through this, call someone somehow.
I mean, I always say to have a safe word with a close friend or family member, neighbor, somebody you can trust, have a safe word. And even if it's just send a text message with that word in it, call them up, and it's your first word. They know that you need help. You've got to, the safety exit routes are so crucial. We need to secure our safety and the safety of our children. And again, if you get into a new relationship, it's really, really important to do a Claire's Law on the new partner. It don't, I mean, it's like, I know sometimes you think, well, oh, well, I feel a little bit underhanded doing that because, they've not shown any signs. And what does that say? That makes me, that suggests I don't trust them. I feel bad about that because they've not actually done anything to cause me to not trust them at this stage. But it is so important. It is so important, particularly, certainly if you decide that it's going somewhere, and before you ever introduce them to your children, 100%, you should be doing a Claire's Law, 110%.
Oh, whilst we're giving advice, Kate, I'm going to throw some in as well. So I usually get parents to, as a part of the plan, make a Claire's Law and maybe a Sarah's Law disclosure, which is about the sexual. Now, I'm also saying to parents, do not move them in too soon.
No, it's a massive red flag, a huge red flag.
It's probably the most common thing. Boyfriend moves in, there's an allegation, there's a disclosure, there's an event.
But the speed that moving that fast anyway is a huge alarm bell anyway. It's no.
This is really sad to say, but I put a post on this probably about 2 years ago, and someone said, there's no stronger love than from a man who's homeless.
Yeah.
I mean that respectfully. Parents, if you can't date for a year without exposing them to the family, you've got a problem.
Yeah.
Take a year if you're interested, or if they're interested in you and they have somewhere to live and they can cope by themselves, it's a lot safer that way. Do not rush.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. You need the relationship has to be on an even footing where there isn't one or the other has an advantage over the other. We need a even footing. You don't want a situation either where you are dependent on another person again, or you're going to be put into a position where they could quite easily entice you to become financially dependent on them. That is a huge no-no. You
I've had situations where housing are encouraging a mother to not allow this boyfriend with a questionable past to be a co to be added to the tenancy.
Yeah.
Don't do it.
No, absolutely
For a
not.
long shot. Not for a long shot. Kate, I could talk all day.
Yeah, those the yeah, I mean, because it is once it, those are what I refer to as escalation points, and that's those are the when I'm doing a timeline, like those are the things that I look for is how have this behavior shifted at each different stage and progression of the relationship. Because
Wow.
it's usually escalation points at every single point, and that shows us a pattern.
Absolutely.
So yeah, moving in is a is one of the moving in and getting engaged are the your two ones where you need to be very, very careful. And if they're doing it very, very soon in the relationship, that's your cue to put the brakes on 100%. Yeah.
Agreed.
Well, thank you, Curtis. It's been great having you on.
Oh, likewise. I
Yeah.
could have gone on.
Yeah, well, I'm sure we can get you on again. But yeah, because it's such an important topic with for lots of reasons for reassurance with families that are nervous about the system and obviously from a safeguarding perspective it's we have to safety is we again we both said the same thing. Safety is always our number one priority. Always. Yeah. Yeah. Forget about digging your heels in and wanting to be right. Safety is always number one.
I
Yeah.
just want to I just want to throw in this point. I know parents are scared. If you put the children first, there is no interest in from anybody to be removing children. Not the courts, not the police. If we have a plan of safety, the children stay with the safe parent. That's it.
And again, it's communicating, isn't it? It's the more you communicate with the services, the if you hide, you're gonna raise suspicion for yourself.
Absolutely.
It's always about communicating as uncomfortable as it is, and it is. I personally can say firsthand, I know how uncomfortable it is, but it's much better to communicate and have a conversation
Then to hide.
than bury your head and hope the problem's going to go away. Because at least then you get that reassurance as well when you communicate with them. So you're putting your own mind at rest by communicating. But yeah, it's so important, so important. Yeah.
Agree.
Yes, well, thank you. It's been great having you.
Thank you.
And we'll see you on the next episode.
Take care.
Thank you for tuning in and being part of this vital conversation. If you feel inspired to take action and support women, girls, and children affected by abuse, please visit the show notes in Kate's bio on UK Health Radio. There, you can register your interest in becoming a certified trauma-informed expert, specialising in topics that address this ever-growing crisis. Together, we can shape a safer future for those who need it most. Until next time, stay strong, stay informed, and remember, you are never alone.